presentation and a chance to speak. So this is some work that I am finishing up right now, just sort of trying to consider what we might be looking for, what we should think about coming up for the next run of the LHC. And the motivation I'm going off here for what to start thinking about is that we do have evidence of new physics, right? We know dark matter exists. We know it's something like five times as much as the baryonic matter that we know and love in the universe. And we know that it can't be any standard model particle. So that implies that we are dealing with new physics, but the problem is we don't know what that new physics is. And given that we are theorists, we have a lot of options. There are neutrinos, are a lot of people's favorites. There's gravitinos, axions, some more generic WIMP that might not be a neutralino. You can start building more complicated stories. The baryons are not simple. So why should the dark matter be simple? So you might imagine some story that I've dubbed here dark atoms, where the dark matter is some more complicated systems that forms bound states and things like that. And then, of course, the most likely option is that it's something else that is either not anything that I've put up here or some combination or extension of what I've put up here. Now, this is going to be a talk about looking for dark matter at colliders, so I should probably motivate why I would expect to ever find dark matter at a collider, given that the only evidence we have right now for dark matter is purely gravitational, and creating black holes aside, we are not probing gravity at the LHC. So there is a familiar story, right? The thermal WIMP, the thermal weakly interacting massive particle. And that's just saying that if you have anything in thermal equilibrium in the early universe, it's going to have a large number density. And this, of course, assumes that the universe started at a temperature that was much larger than the mass, so it can be in thermal equilibrium. And as the universe cools, that particle will annihilate with itself, going into the lighter particles by assumption of the standard model. And its relic number density will decrease, and eventually it will freeze out. And that's just the plot that we all know and love here, where time is going this way, decreasing temperature going this way. The number density just decreases and decreases due to annihilation, and eventually the annihilation becomes inefficient. You freeze out, you're left with a relic. Of course, this story is true of all standard model particles, as well as a dark matter candidate that is created this way. So if you want to have a thermal dark matter candidate, you have to have an annihilation cross-section, and we're going to assume often that that annihilation cross-section goes into standard model particles. Now, that is, of course, only one way to build dark matter. There are others, and so is it reasonable to assume that non-thermal dark matter will have some non-gravitational interaction with the standard model? And I would argue that while it's not certain, it is at least an interesting and reasonable possibility. And the point is that any particle that was in thermal equilibrium will have a thermal relic abundance, right? And so if you want to make your dark matter a non-thermal candidate, you have to get rid of the thermal piece, right? Or you have to argue for some reason that it was never in equilibrium. You could always have it annihilate into non-standard model particles, so you wouldn't be producing it at colliders. But then you have to now tell me why this new particle it annihilated into is not the dark matter or not a thermal relic, so you'd have to get rid of this new particle as well. And so the argument here is just that if you want to get rid of your dark matter, even if it's not a thermal candidate, you either have to make it never in equilibrium or you have to allow for some process that allows you to convert dark matter particles into standard model particles. There's an example of this that I've thought about in the past and I think illustrates the point nicely, which is that you can have asymmetric dark matter. And the motivation here is that everything around us, baryons, are a non-thermal candidate. If you only cared about the thermal component of baryons, you'd have a lot less of it to play around with. We have some large proton asymmetry, and the thermal relic component of protons and antiprotons is down by like a factor of 10 to the 10. So the one thing that we know about from the real universe is not anything like a WIMP. And so maybe just the fact that the dark matter and the baryons are...
So this is not entirely true, right? Cosmic microwave background is a thermal distribution.
Right. But those are today a much smaller component of the universe than us or dark matter, right? And this is, we don't know what dark matter is, and so we're just making a series of reasonable guesses, right? And Yeah, I mean, the fact that these are only off by a factor of 5 and not a factor of 1,000 or 100,000 maybe is telling you something. And there's, of course, many papers thinking about this in the asymmetric story. But the point is that even if you want to build some non-thermal candidate in an asymmetric model, you still need to get rid of the thermal component. And here is just the number density. It's following, you know, the Boltzmann number density. And then instead of both of them freezing out, you have the particle, which I assume had some initial asymmetry, just runs out of antiparticles to annihilate with, and the antiparticle number density keeps decreasing. But you still, in order to get rid of this thermal component, you actually still need to have an annihilation cross-section that turns out to be comparable to WIMPs. That's at least an explicit realization of this kind of idea where even though you're not talking about a thermal candidate, you still have this early universe annihilation. Which means, of course, as we all know, you can turn this diagram in various directions. You can have direct detection, dark matter scattering off the standard model today. You can have indirect detection, dark matter going to standard model particles in the universe. And the one that I'll be spending most of the time of this talk talking about is standard model particles going through some interaction into dark matter. Of course, we are theorists, and you can think of many ways to avoid the conclusion that I've just come to. Axions are the obvious scenario. In that case, you just never make them in thermal equilibrium, so you never have to worry about getting rid of them. So you can clearly avoid this argument, and you can build all sorts of interesting new physics out of it. But if we don't know what we're looking for, I think this captures a large number of possible models, and it makes it reasonable to expect that we can look for dark matter out of the LHC, and it should motivate searches in that direction. So one thing we need to keep in mind when we're talking about combining searches in the colliders or in indirect detection or direct detection is that we don't actually, you will see, I will make a bunch of slides where we compare what these different bounds would be, but we don't actually know what's going on perfectly in all of these different systems. And so given a model, you can make what I'm calling quote unquote exact predictions for discovery or exclusion in these different experimental regions, but you have to keep in mind what you assumed. And the canonical example, and one that I've been thinking about as well, is in direct detection, where you talk about some rate as a function of the recoil energy of dark matter scattering off your target. And you say, okay, well, there's some particle physics that goes into the cross-section as a function of the recoil energy, the mass of the dark matter, but then the actual rate of particles or scattering events I would see depends on this density of dark matter and this velocity distribution of dark matter in the galaxy around us. And that's astrophysics. And there are canonical assumptions you can make here, but we don't know if they're true. And what I'm showing here is work that I'm doing with Allison Brooks and a grad student, Jonathan Sloan, and hopefully be coming out relatively soon, where what we're looking at are simulations of dark matter halos that are done with baryons. So these are high resolution simulations. We have 4 galaxies that look like the Milky Way. Before this, the state of the art was 1 galaxy that looked like the Milky Way. So we don't have a lot of statistics, but we're getting there. And what I'm showing here is just the density, the velocity profile of dark matter for a Milky Way type halo. And this is the standard halo model. This is the one that you see when you're trying to predict what Lux will see or what Cogent will see. And it has some distribution here, and then it cuts off there. And if you know about the direct detection experiments, you're only tending to probe the very, very high velocity particles. They're the only ones moving fast enough to give you an interesting scattering event. If I put in dark matter only, and I simulate these using this are state-of-the-art simulation codes right now, you get a distribution that looks like this. And these are just all 4 of the different galaxies piled on top of each other. And you notice that is significantly different from the standard halo model assumption. You put in baryons, you do shift the profile up again higher, but you're again not seeing something that looks like the standard halo model. And you're lacking a lot of dark matter at high velocities. And that will change the results that you're going to expect from direct detection. And the point of this for the purpose...
So how is this consistent with what people found before and, using, what's his name, Coulomb?
Yeah, dark matter.
I mean, they found things which are closer to the usual thing, but their deviation is at high velocity, as you say, but nothing like
The dark matter only one. There may be slight differences in the masses of the dark matter halos that we're looking at. The ones that I'm looking at are slightly lower mass than I believe the ones in the Kuan et al. Paper. And one of the things we'll be doing in the final publication of this is taking into that account, that effect, right?
This
one is very surprising. It's shockingly low, and we have to understand fully the differences.
Velocity isn't, I mean, that doesn't even match the rough P0s that we know by at our radius.
Mm-hmm.
So is the issue something like there's less matter in there, so everything's moving
slower? I think that's probably the leading order effect. We do have a couple of larger mass galaxies at lower resolution that have to be included. The interesting thing for us was right now is the large difference between the baryons and the dark matter, because those are comparing like to like.
You're saying it might be the
thing which there may be an overall scaling factor moving it up. Yeah. And in which case, you may end up with a larger scattering rate at lux today.
But they didn't include baryons.
Right now, there's only been sort of one result with baryons, and it's, you only have that one galaxy, and every galaxy, as you simulate it, turns out to be slightly different. So you see sort of weird structures in here that may or may not be real, depending on the statistical issue.
How long does it take to simulate?
About 6 months per galaxy, I think.
How many CPUs
start that? Allison has told me this. It is many, many years of CPU time. These are not cheap to make. And they were originally simulated not for... these were not simulated for this, this is a sort of side project based off of what they were intending to look at it for. But the point here is that, you can get into, a lot of very interesting scientific debates about what the astrophysical or the other assumptions going into your bounds are. And so when we are looking at colliders, we should not say, oh, this model is ruled out because of direct detection or indirect detection, therefore it is not interesting. Because we are probing it in a different way, the uncertainties are different, and issues like this may be hiding, or may convince us that interesting physics has already been ruled out when it hasn't. Yeah. What the result is on Lux, you mean? I don't have that plot fully made. If this was the velocity profile that we had in the galaxy today, it will be significantly lower at lux for the low mass dark matter. You can just tell based on the fact that we're missing a bunch of the velocity up here. But we just haven't quite made that plot yet. The grad student's in the middle of it right now, actually. No, this is gravitational only. What's going on here is that as the baryons move around because of supernova and star formation, usually that doesn't matter. On a grand scale, there is way more dark matter than baryons. And so that's the thing that drives what a gravitational profile looks like. However, when you're close in, and we are close in where there are a lot of baryons, and I know that because I'm standing on a planet, right? There's a lot of baryons around us, and so they tend to pull the gravitational potential around in a way that shifts the velocity profile, right? So, this is just coming from gravitational interactions between the two sectors, right? Now, there's a lot of scattering physics going into how the baryons move, and that's why baryon simulations are extremely computationally intensive, right? But there's no self-scattering going on here. Yeah.
Galaxies, bulges, disks.
Say again?
In a spiral galaxy, you have disks and bulge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have baryons and bulge near the core.
Yeah.
So how does that affect
this? That is what is part of what is causing this shift. Yeah, is the fact that we are relatively close to a very, very large concentration of baryons, and as they move around, they pull the dark matter. Yeah.
From the center.
Yeah. If we were further out, the difference would be smaller. But we're not, so. And this is the thing, right? We live in a particular place, and I don't care what an average galaxy does. I actually care about what the Milky Way does, specifically right here. And that could be very different from what we kind of generically expect. Okay, so with that caveat in our minds, now we should ask, okay, if we want to look for dark matter at colliders, how do we do that? Well, if you had a full theory, for example, supersymmetry, some UV complete theory, you can look for the new dark matter, non-dark matter particles, gluons, galenos, quarks, things like that, and they're probably going to decay down to dark matter depending on your theory, but these new non-dark matter particles, by definition, have stronger interactions with the standard model, they're easier to look for. But we're trying to be relatively agnostic here. And if you don't know what the full theory is, you can't look for other new particles. You have to look for the dark matter by itself, so you look for nothing. More specifically, what you look for is nothing going in one direction, the dark matter going one way, recoiling against something visible going the other direction, some high PT jet, a W, a photon, something like that. And it turns out that at the LHC, the monojet signature of a high PT jet going one direction, a lot of missing energy going to the other direction, is one of the more sensitive constraints. This is what the signature would actually look like in one of the detectors. So if you're going to look for this, your signature of new physics of dark matter is buried in an extremely large background. There's a lot of things in the standard model that can look like nothing and a jet. There is real irreducible background of neutrinos going in one direction. Also, the failure mode of an event tends to look like missing energy if you just mismeasure something. And so I will come back in more detail to what these searches are, but I do want to point out right now this is a really impressive experimental accomplishment, because in previous Hadron machines, this was sort of the garbage collection of all of these terrible events that we didn't understand. And so the fact that we can really map what is going on here is the result of a lot of work from the experimental community.
On the right side plot.
Oh, so here?
That should be the one that was not in the
back. Yeah, here.
Maybe it's control region.
Yeah, this one.
It's okay, it's not his plot. No.
Yeah, sorry. The colors are also a little screwy here. It's weird because it was actually listed as Z-nu-nu, but I didn't see it anyway. Okay, so we can do these searches, and we want to compare the bounds that we're placing on bounds from dark matter in other directions. So how do we do that? So we're not observing, missing energy plus jets above background. How do we interpret this? You can, again, build more complicated models where you assume that there's some mediator traveling between the dark matter and the standard model, either T-channel or S-channel. But for a long time, the way to do this, to think about this, has been in terms of effective operators, where you just integrate out whatever your new physics is, and you're left with direct operators connecting dark matter and the standard model suppressed by some mass scale. And this is a very useful way to think about it. There was an exhaustive list of operators from this paper a couple of years ago. I've only written down a couple of them, and Tim Tate usually has to apologize for the naming scheme, because they're just sort of listed off as the kind of dark matter, Dirac, complex scalar, real scalar, and then just a list of numbers after that in somewhat the order in which he thought of them. But this is sort of a standard way to think about it, and it's been a lot of the experimental results have been put in terms of this. So here I'm putting an experimentalist paper where they were just combining a lot of different search strategies together. Massive dark matter. They chose to write this suppression scale lambda as M star as a mass scale. And then just all of these different operators, the limit on this scale lambda or M star that can be placed from the experimental constraints. So the nice thing about this is that you can then take that physics and say, I didn't see an excess at the colliders. Well, what bound will that place on dark matter in direct detection? And so what you can do is here, this is spin-dependent and spin-independent constraints. Again, massive dark matter, now scattering cross-section. And these were the bounds at the time that CMS put this paper out at on the dark matter scattering from direct detection. And then these are the constraints that you're taking from your collider search. And you see that at high mass, you're not winning, but at low mass, for spin independent, you are winning from the collider search. Again, we have to remember there were a bunch of astrophysical assumptions that went into this plot. And for spin-dependent, you tend to do a lot better than the direct detection experiments because it's hard to get as large of a target that is sensitive to spin-dependent constraints. And then finally, I'll just put up one plot from a paper that I was working on where there was some, at the time, interesting signal seen in direct detection. And again, the effect of operator formalism allows you to just take this particular signature from direct detection, convert it into a necessary suppression scale in the effective operator, and say, well, what are the bounds from different searches that you can kind of pile on top of each other, and does anything look consistent? So this was a collider search. This is another collider search I'll come back to in more detail. Indirect detection, the direct detection favored regions at the time, and then the thermal relic constraint, if you are assuming that your dark matter is a thermal relic. So this is really useful, and of course we've done a lot of work on it over the years, but now we know that there is a fairly significant limitation for effective field theories in dark matter. That means we have to start thinking about new things.
And I think we knew that moment that paper came out. But that's
we've finally made the plots that prove that we really shouldn't be thinking about it this way if we want to go forward. Which, again, I'm not saying that this was a terrible way to think about it, but we do have to come up with new ideas. And the problem is just that when you take the EFT, what you're doing is you're saying that the momentum going in the propagator is small enough compared to the mass scale of whatever that new physics is that I can just totally ignore it. I'm just ignoring these pieces up here in the expansion. You can require, you know, if you require that these couplings are perturbative, you can make some constraint just on what the relationship between the mass scale and the dark matter that you're probing. But then more worryingly at the LHC is that in order to see these things, something had to get kicked sideways with a lot of momentum. There was a lot of energy transfer going through your production of dark matter, and you do have to require that that transfer of momentum is low compared to the mass scale. And if you look as a function of the jet PT, which is going to be giving you an estimate of the transfer momentum, this paper here, what they looked at was just the mass of the dark matter, various PTs that you'd be sensitive to, assuming you know what your experimental setup was like, and then just the momentum that is the transfer momentum going through your production. And what you see is that you're already starting probing momentums that are nearly a TeV if you start putting in larger cuts. And so right now we might be down here. We're requiring a PT of a jet of 120, say. But at later, at 13 TeV at the LHC, we're going to probably be up here in order to cut down on backgrounds. And so you can also just look at how much of the LHC cross-section in an effective theory is coming from a region where you can actually say that the transfer momentum is lower than the mass scale you're claiming that you're integrating out up to. And so this is just this ratio, amount that you trust the EFT compared to the full cross-section. And again, you have to make some assumptions, the mass of the dark matter, the PT of the jet, or keep the mass of the dark matter free and set the PT of the jet. And you just see that generically, there's a lot of this region where this ratio is small, right? The EFT is not a good theory at the LHC. And what that's just saying is that the LHC is probing kinematic regions where the mediators are kinematically accessible. Right, like you're producing the physics that is giving you the dark matter directly. And I would say that this is, in some sense, a theory problem more than an experimental problem. Looking for missing energy is still a viable way to look for dark matter. But if we had seen something, we would just interpret the results incorrectly. Right? Or our lack of seeing something is leading us to interpret the results somewhat incorrectly because we're assuming that the EFT is good even when it's not. But this is also good news in the sense that we're saying that if you're capable of producing dark matter at the LHC, you're very likely capable of producing the new physics that couples the dark matter to us at the LHC. And that means we're not looking in the best channels, we're not using the maximum amount of information possible, and so we should start thinking about moving beyond the effective operators and going back to simplified models, or going back to models that contain not just dark matter, but the new physics that couple to dark matter. And the general idea is that in order to get your jet, you're paying some order 10 suppression just to get a high PT jet. And whatever your new physics is, had standard model interactions, so maybe that will be easier to look for than the, by definition, invisible dark matter. Oh, it depends on what the PT cut it is, but you're going to knock down your cross sections. Yeah. Sorry. Just requiring the jet is already, you know, giving you a hit, and then the higher PT you require, the bigger the jet. Of course, you know, we lose generality once you move beyond an effective theory because you now have to make assumptions about what that new physics is. We have more parameters we have to worry about. So just a quick review of what other people have been thinking about for my work. One of the easiest things you can imagine is just a T-channel operator where you have quarks going through some T-channel, which now has to be colored and charged and giving you dark matter, either fermionic or scalar. This is really similar to squarks plus a neutralino. And we're just sort of ignoring the rest of the supersymmetric parameter space, but you're now just reduced to the mass of the mediator, the mass of the dark matter, and a single coupling between the two. And there have been a couple of papers. I'm probably forgetting to cite all of them, but these are just some constraints on that coupling as a function of the two masses, mass of the dark matter, mass of the mediator. This is what you're sensitive to coming from the LHC. This is what you'd be sensitive to coming from direct detection. And you see this right now, generically, direct detection wins, except down in this sort of region down here where the collider starts winning again. The other thing you can do, very simply, is start looking at S-channel operators where you have your dark matter going through some new particle on resonance or a new resonance that can give you dark matter. And there's been a lot of papers on this as well. You have two options. You can have a vector or axial vector, or you can have a scalar. I will be spending the rest of this talk talking about the scalar and pseudoscalar choices, but just to show you right now the possibility of the constraints for the vector and the axial vector models right here. Coupling to the dark matter, you have to make an assumption about the coupling to the standard model, mass of the dark matter, and then the mass of the mediator that you're looking for, and then just the various constraints from the LHC, jets plus missing energy, the LHC die-jet searches, and then previous die-jet searches from the Tevatron. Right, so as I'll show in a second, you have a lot more, you have five parameters you have to worry about. So what they did here is they just picked the mass of the dark matter, picked the coupling, and then in this region here, you're sensitive to, you would have seen this in the LHC missing energy search. In these regions here, you would have seen this in the LHC die-jet search. You would have seen the resonance just going to die-jets, and then at the LHC 7, and then down here in the Tevatron. But you notice, you know, once you get below a certain mass, it's extremely difficult to look for die-jet resonances, as we know.
Did they look at a parameter space of this, like marginalizing over the mass of the
I'd have to, and these papers looked at more than one mass of dark matter. It's just, it's a five, you know, four or five dimensional parameter space, and there's no way to plot over. I can't show you a slice, you know, I have to show you slices. I can't show you the full parameter space. I know that they looked over more choices than this.
The changes, like larger, is always kind of in the same.
I mean, you can see what will happen if you reduce this. I mean, you can always make these models invisible at the LHC if you just reduce the coupling to the quarks, then you don't produce your new physics, right? So you do have to make some assumption about this. If you just set this to zero, then this goes away, all right? But they sort of, there are no surprises. There's no sort of hidden region where there was something interesting that jumped out that said, oh, this, you know we've actually found something at the LHC that we didn't know about. It makes sense when you just sort of scan over these parameters. So, and these these plots were just sort of chosen as sort of nice illustrations of what's going on when you look at these.
So is this dip from the monitor? That's just because below that one, so the graphite goes and comes back out. Is that just because below that you're below the threshold for decay into dark matter?
Let's see. Well, right down here you're going to start going into off shell. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's off shell.
Yeah. Yeah. And your backgrounds might change it down there as well. Okay. So that's sort of what we've been thinking about right now, and then the work that I've been doing recently has been on spin zero mediators, scalars and pseudoscalars. And I find this kind of interesting because it is in a certain sense easy to accommodate extra scalars or extra pseudoscalars and extended Higgs sectors. you might generically expect then, if you do have just an extra scalar or an extra pseudoscalar, that it might mix with the Higgs sector. And so you might expect that the couplings of your new particle would couple to the fermions proportional to their standard model Yukawa couplings. And so I'm going to make that assumption for the remainder of this talk. And this minimal flavor violation assumption also allows me to avoid a lot of very nasty and powerful flavor constraints. And so I think this is a reasonable way to proceed right now. The other interesting thing about these kind of models is that the constraints are really weak at this particular moment. And that's kind of interesting. If it's really hard to see these new particles, even at very low masses, it means that, you know, we're not looking for them very efficiently. We can do better, and that means that there could be physics that we can find not only at LHC-13, but if we go back and look at the older data sets, you know, it's worthwhile to do. And I just mentioned, this is work that I've been doing with my graduate student, David Feld, and a postdoc, Dorival Gonsalves. So the goal here is just to come up with benchmark models and show how well we are doing looking for them right now. Right? And so I have two benchmark models. We either introduce a new scalar or a new pseudoscalar. It's going to have some mediator mass, couples to, I'm going to assume, Dirac dark matter, just for simplicity. The dark matter has a mass that I don't know. I'm going to assume that the couplings to the standard model fermions are proportional to the Yukawa couplings in the standard model times some overall scale that I don't know. So there's an overall coupling to the visible sector, GV, and a coupling to the dark matter, G chi. Right, and so you could imagine in general that this GV might be different for the up sector and the down sector and the leptons, but just for today, I'm going to keep it sort of constant across all of these. So you have what I would consider a five-dimensional parameter space. You have the mass of your mediator, mass of your dark matter, the two couplings to the dark sector, to the visible sector, and then I'm going to throw in the width of the dark matter as another, another parameter that I don't know.
The mediator.
Just because I am doing a simplified model, there could be more complicated things going on, and so maybe there are additional decays that could open up. In principle, if I just knew these four parameters, I could tell you what this is, but I just want to keep this as open as a free parameter. And also I'll show you, for very large widths, you affect the collider bounds. So keep in mind all the caveats I said about we don't understand the dark matter velocity profile, but you can convert for the scalar mediator, you'll end up getting spin-independent direct detection signals. They tend to be relatively independent of the width. We have constraints from Lux and CDMS. And so I can place an upper limit on this combination of couplings to the visible and the dark sector as a function of mediator and dark matter mass. And so you see that sort of around, you know, couplings of one or less are allowed in this region right here. There is a really big change as you move up to about 6 or 7 GeV, and that's just where Lux stops being sensitive and CDMS starts being sensitive, or the best bound. So that just gives you an idea of the range of couplings you might be interested in for the scalar model. The pseudoscalar model doesn't have spin independent or actually velocity non-suppressed spin dependent bounds, but it does have thermal annihilations in the universe today that are velocity independent. And so using indirect detection, just looking for annihilation in the sky today, we can place bounds on the coupling as well. So what I've done here is I've just taken the dwarf annihilation constraints where they've just looked at all these dwarf galaxies, looked for anomalous production of gamma rays. I'm going to assume that the annihilation went into BB bar. That's a reasonable assumption to make because the couplings are proportional to the Yukawas. There's a slight dependence on the width, but not terribly large. And so here I just made some assumption about the width in order to make a plot for you. And again, I'm showing you the couplings on the bound on the combination of couplings as a function of the masses of the mediator and the dark matter. And you see that for a large region, sort of couplings of order one or slightly less may be constrained. Up here is where the top channel should turn on, and unfortunately, Fermi didn't give us a bound on annihilation into tops for very large masses. But this just gives you a general idea of the kind of couplings that we might be interested in. Finally, if I...
Yeah,
the interesting thing is that the coupling constraints start getting ridiculous at some point, right? I mean, above 10, you don't believe that this model is anywhere close to being right, right? This is just a really naive bound, and I'm going to, at several points in this talk, you will see constraints on the couplings of 100, right? The way to interpret that is just, you know, you could have physics hiding with much more reasonable values that you just would not be able to see in this range, right? I could have capped this out, but you know, formally you can put a bound on it. Similarly, I can just say, if this is a thermal relic, what coupling combination do you need? Again, you need combinations of couplings on the order of 1 to maybe 10, right? And again, there's huge numbers of ways to violate this if you just want to do a little more complicated model building. For one thing, I only have these channels turned on. So there's a lot of things you could do with this model if you were so interested. This is for scalars, and then I do it again for pseudoscalars. But generically, the bounds are fairly similar. So now I just want to look at what's available for collider bounds. We can just take the MET-related signatures of scalars or pseudoscalars going to dark matter. The interesting thing is that once you start putting in this resonance, you can now look for dark or your mediator going to combinations of fermions, right? And so these are channels that we haven't really looked at efficiently. We need to, as I'll talk about at the end, we need to think about how to look for these channels. And just the which ones of these are going to win depends on the relative size of your couplings to the visible sector compared to your dark sector. If the branching ratio goes largely into missing energy, obviously you want to look in that channel. Of course, the LHC will always have difficulty if you just dial down the coupling to the visible sector. There's no way around it.
You're not being entirely fair about the efforts here, right? People have been looking for resonance, hadronic resonance that isn't generally it's just difficult.
It is extremely, I mean, the experimentalists are looking under every rock that they can, and these are extremely difficult channels. But I think there is motivation to not only continue, you know, to increase our efforts, but also present the results in a way that allows us to place limits on these kinds of models in a way that is very difficult to do at the moment. So what I'm going to do now is just show you the bounds coming from the MET channels using CMS and Atlas work. For a large number of the visible channels, I think we need to think about new searches, and that's one of the things that is going to be sort of next on the list of these models. I'm just going to show the bounds from the monojet search. POPs plus MET, here is where, because you're assuming a large coupling to TT bar, you can assume you could look for radiation of your new scalar or pseudoscalar off of TT bar that then goes to missing energy. Bottoms plus MET, and then for reasons that I'll explain, it's very difficult to scan over the masses of the mediator, so I'm just going to show you two benchmark models, 100 GeV and 375 GeV benchmarks for the mediator masses. And then, of course, additional searches are possible, but will require closer collaboration with the experimentalists to really build an effective search. So the search that's going to give us the best bound is, of course, the monojet search. And here, I'm using the CMS search simply because they publish results with the largest amount of luminosity. Atlas has a very similar search that, in general, would be as sensitive. You're requiring a lot of missing energy, 120 GeV, for the initial selection. You have to require a jet with very large PT, 110 GeV or higher. They call this a monojet search. It's actually a dijet search. You can allow a second jet with 30 GeV or more, but no more jets than two above 30 GeV. And then your MET bins are, you know, 250 GeV and up. CMS really helpfully gives us enough information that you can just take their bounds and take your new model and look at the constraints that you would derive from that. So that's what we did. However, there is an issue here. And that's that the assumption that I'm making that the scalar or pseudoscalar couple is proportional to mass means that I'm producing this largely through couplings to T and B. However, you know, protons don't contain a lot of T bar, B, and B bar. And that means if you just took the coupling to the light quarks, you'd get extremely weak bounds on, for example, the scalar EFT operator, which has the same assumption. You can see this where this is the plot from the paper I mentioned earlier. These are the constraints from the experiments on the scalar and pseudoscalar operators are very, very weak when you compare to the bounds on vector and axial vector mediators. Right. So exactly like the Higgs, if I'm coupling to top, I have the top loop. And that generates a couple of gluons. And in fact, in the plot that I showed you before, they simply did not, they didn't throw that extra piece in of the top generated loop, right? And so this is going to be the main way that you'd produce your scalar for monojets. And if you look at the effect on the EFT results, this was the bound if you don't assume that the loop exists, and the bound, at least according to this paper, increases up to this level once you put in this coupling to gluons induced by the loop. However,
so what do you actually use for the when you simulate it, what do you actually use for the coupling?
I'm going to address that right now. No, that is the obvious question of how do you actually get these constraints. And the problem is that if I took something like MadGraph and I wanted to generate this scalar or pseudoscalar just by integrating out a top loop, that's MadGraph can only treat this like an effective field theory, right? I've taken that top loop and I've condensed it down to a point, and I can calculate in some limit what the value of that interaction should be, but it turns out that that's not good enough. And the reason it's not good enough is that in a monojet search, the jet PT, the PT of the particle you're producing, which is the missing energy, the missing transverse energy, all of these things are large compared to twice the top mass. Because we're, in principle, scanning over the mass of our new particle, that mass could be large as well, which means there's a significant amount of momentum flowing through this top loop, and you can't just treat it like an integrated out effective operator. It's not just a K factor changing the overall scaling of the cross section. It's changing the differential distribution. And I hope you can see this right here. We used an exact calculation that actually included all of the momentum going through this compared to the effective field theory result you would get if you integrated out the loop for 100 GeV mediator and a 375 GeV mediator. And if you can see, the EFT differential cross-section for the jet PT looks like this. The exact result has a significantly different slope and falls off faster with jet PT. Similar things happen with missing energy, exact effective field theory. And so because we are only sensitive to this region over, right, if you had just taken MadGraph and generated these results, you would over-predict the number of events that would fall into your signal bin.
Called silly.
Say again?
This should be, I mean, that's why we're doing our equation called silly, right? Like, this is not an EFT. I mean, you're doing exactly what you shouldn't be doing in EFT. I'm not
right.
criticizing what you're showing, I'm just criticizing the name.
Okay.
Right? I mean, the whole point of EFT is to keep all the degrees of freedom that are relevant.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you're not doing by putting it at the points.
Very. So this is just sort of what I'm saying is that the mediator mass is, you know, you can't assume that the thing you're producing, unlike the Higgs, is small compared to the relative energy scales. So what we did, and this is what Dorival Gonzalez helped us out with a lot, was using MCFM. We modified that to produce simulated events so that we could actually run this through the event selection of the CMS result. And we simulated mediator plus a single jet with the exact dependence on the top mass. We have to use the narrow width approximation because MCFM couldn't handle a non-narrow width particle. And then we showered with Pythia 8 and we did some jet finding. And we're going to compare that to MadGraph results matched at 2-jet, where unfortunately, because of the way MadGraph works, we have to do, as you say, the silly way, where you assume that that operator is just a value that you can calculate.
Matt, I think there's a way, and I think it's probably hard to. In MadGraph, I think you can actually modify some things that specify the functional dependence.
That is something that seems like it's being implemented.
Yeah,
but
so I don't know if that would be faster than MCFM. So it's not an analog, you're just putting the
Yeah.
Except there's some people who've done it going to be done.
Yeah, it's beginning to become something that can be used.
We've done it with MadGraph for proton form factor, but I think for the Higgs loop coupling, because it is an effective operator, there's some trickier stuff with this implementation.
It is clear that they are building MadGraph in a way that would help, would allow you to do this. We looked into it. We couldn't get it to work. One of the things, I mean, even this MCFM result, which I'm calling exact, is not quite perfect because I'm only simulating a single jet. I'm allowing, you know, extra jets to show up because of the showering, but really it's a dijet search or a monojet plus a dijet search. And so there are effects that we have to worry about, but this is at least sort of the best result we could get, though it does take a lot longer to do. Yeah.
Why are you not considering flight-taking into post?
Simply because it is a simpler assumption. This is just a simplified model where I'm assuming if it had gone into W or Z, then I'm sort of looking more at a Higgs model where the constraints going into W and Z would probably be the primary way to look for this thing. But because the signature
has no electronic background.
Right. I do include that possibility through the same top loop. It's just for the constraints. The branching ratio for that is incredibly small. Right. You'd have to dial down the coupling to dark matter to an extremely small value for that to win. Yeah.
Which is still true for the Higgs boson.
Yeah. That is why I'm not going to show you a BBBO resonance search, because we haven't figured that out. We have to work. We have to do more work to get that to go. But it's seen that the two photon resonance search outside of a coupling that's very, very small to dark matter wouldn't win simply because of the branching ratios are suppressed in this case because you preferentially decay to dark matter for reasonable coupling.
Right. I guess the other point is that regardless of, I mean, for the question of gamma gamma versus BB bar, I mean, the dark matter branching fraction doesn't matter. Yeah. But the extent that the dark matter branching fraction makes the resonance much broader. And the power of gamma gamma is in mass resolution. If the resonance is naturally broad because of sizable dark matter decay mode, gamma gamma is not that good.
No, but we don't know too much about this phi.
No, we don't know anything about it. I've made an assumption that it has a particular set of couplings. And I agree that in general, like if we're talking about you know this full set of searches that we want to do, yes, looking for resonances or perhaps slightly wider, you know, things that have a width that is not incredibly narrow in gamma gamma is of course the signature that we should be looking into. And I believe I'm certain that there are. Yeah.
Top triangle is way down. The same is true of Higgs. It's down by 200 or 300. This is why this Higgs has to be a scalar, because it's decay to two photons.
The final states we're looking at, I think we get, I mean, we get reasonable production going into, I'll show you the result. So as I said, we're keeping the total width of, as a free parameter. If there was no other effect, just changing the width should change the bound on the combination of couplings in this particular way, because basically you're just changing the branching ratio into the final state that you're sensitive to. And so that is the general effect that you've seen, actually, if you look at, for example, CMS results, where they have constraints making one assumption of the width and then another assumption of the width where it's larger, and you just decrease the branching ratio into dark matter. And if you just work out the ratio, this decrease is only due to branching ratio. However, for very large widths, and I'll show you what I mean very, very large widths in a moment, the experimental acceptance will change, right? Basically, your resonance is not really a resonance. It doesn't have to have the same invariant mass all the time. And we included those effects, but we could only include those effects using MadGraph because MCFM is narrow width only. So just to show you what I mean by that, here is the scalar at 100 GeV. This is the CMS total background. This is the CMS sort of upper limit on the signal bins. And then this was the MCFM result, which makes a narrow width assumption. If I assume that the ratio of width to mass is a tenth, you start you have a differential distribution which has slightly larger high met objects. If you assume that the ratio is 10, which again is somewhat ridiculous, but it illustrates the point, you actually kick that distribution out even further. And so your experimental acceptance will start changing as you increase the width. And then the same thing here, just shown for 375 GeV. The other channels that I'm going to look at are a lot simpler. If I want to look at TOPS plus MET, I don't have to play as many games with the gluon coupling because the primary production is coming off of real TOPS diagrams like this, where I don't have to close the loop. So I can use Magraph 5 models. I'm using this particular CMS search just because they gave us enough information to convert the bounds into a new model. It's a dileptone plus MET channel. And the primary constraints are you have to have extremely large MET, 320 GeV, or fairly large MET, and relatively low jet PT and some high PT leptons. And this has been optimized for dark matter, but for specifically for dark matter, 100 GeV. Yep.
What on earth do you mean by gamma over n?
I mean that you probably don't want to think of it as a single resonance mediator, but you can. Again, yeah, it's, you don't want to go out that far. It just, you can.
I mean, gamma over n equal to 1 is already pushing it.
Yeah.
But the operationally, what you did is you just took a Gaussian and blew up.
Magraph will accept ridiculous widths for its particles, and it will still accurately model them as a Gaussian with a very, very wide. So basically, it's just saying that whatever you're producing has some huge couplings and presumably is some strong interacting sector and doing all sorts of weird things, and this is probably not the way to think about it. But at some point, that turns off and turns into that new model that we don't understand.
Do you know if Magraph distorts the spectrum? Because, I mean, when it's not narrowed, you have to use the full form of the propagator, and that tilts it towards the low. So I'm wondering how much it will happen.
I think it does. Since our masses were relatively low, we didn't tend to hit that too much, but I think you do tend to shift towards lower PT or lower invariant mass objects simply because you're. And then finally, there's just a bottom plus MET search. There wasn't one that's motivated or dedicated to dark matter, so we just took a spottom search with one or two B jets, some amount of PT, some amount of HT. And just keep in mind that this was really not designed to find a resonance going to dark matter plus jets. So I'm just going to take all of those bounds and show you the current constraints from these searches. I'm going to assume that the dark matter is less than half the mass of the mediator. You're producing the mediator, then it goes into dark matter. If the dark matter was heavier, presumably the mediator, when you produce it, goes into visible states only, and so you shouldn't look in those visible states. And for technical reasons, the scan over the mediator mass is impractical. It took us over 2 days to generate the MCFM results for a single mass point, so we just didn't have the computing time to generate a full scan. So these are the scalar bounds for mass of the dark matter of 100 GeV for 370, mass of the mediator of 100 GeV, mass of the dark matter 5 GeV, mediator 375, mass of dark matter 5 GeV, mass of dark matter 40, mass of dark matter 40. And there's a lot of lines on here, let me just go through it relatively quickly. This is mediator width over mediator mass. Obviously, you know, this is 1, so maybe you don't want to believe anything past here. This is the combination of couplings GV times G chi square root. These horizontal lines are the direct detection bounds. Again, assuming that we understand what's going on with the standard halo model. The black dotted lines are the TT bar bounds. The solid red line is the exact MCFM result, making an assumption that we can just scale with the narrow width approximation up. Magraph results, which can include the width, you see start getting weaker as you go to very large mediator widths. And so then these sort of shaded regions are our interpolation of what the MCFM result would look like if you included the non-narrow width effect. And the point is, it just, you know, for a lot of this you know, a narrow width, you're sensitive to couplings of around 1. If you assume that the width is given exactly by, there are no other decay channels, and the coupling to dark matter and the coupling to the visible sector are equal, the gray regions are theoretically excluded simply because the width I've assumed is narrower than the total width. So that means that if the couplings were equal, the width that you'd be sensitive to would be somewhere around here. That's where you could actually look for the particle. However, there's an assumption there, and that's the couplings are equal. If the couplings are not equal, you can change this drastically. You can move this up. And so I don't think that that's a constraint that you can actually take into account. This line right here is the BB bar search, and notice it is much weaker than the rest of them. And that's simply because the search, I think, has not really been optimized to look for this kind of physics. And then again, for the pseudoscalar bounds, and the point is, right now, I have indirect detection is a constraint for 40 GeV dark matter, and I don't have direct detection for a constraint. But again, the kind of couplings that you'd be sensitive to are around order 1. Okay. So just to conclude, LHC run 2 is something that's coming up very fast, right? And now is the time, if you have new physics searches, to talk to the experimentalists and start getting them to be something that can be implemented. For me, dark matter is a really strong motivation for new physics, and specifically for something to look for at the LHC, even if it's not a WIMP. There's a lot more out there in the parameter space of theory models for dark matter than just neutrinos and WIMPs. As we know, EFTs are not really applicable for the physics that we are sensitive to at the LHC, so we have to think of new ways to parameterize these models. The fact that they're not applicable means that we're leaving useful information on the table. There are particles that we'd be producing that we can look for, which presumably are easier to look for than the EFT. And right now, the simplified model approach, I think, is really useful because it allows us to do searches without getting too tied down to a specific model. So scalars and pseudoscalars, I think, are one of the more interesting, well-motivated in terms of extended Higgs sectors, and actually really difficult searches to do. And so I think these require a little more thought. There are issues with the simulations because of these loop-induced gluon couplings that have large PTs flowing through them, so it requires a little bit of thought. But we've figured out how to solve that problem, even if it takes a computationally fair amount of time. And what I've shown today is just the existing LHC searches on MET. There are a lot of searches that need to be considered. Right, you can go to BB bar, which, as you said, is something we can't, you know, is very difficult even for the Higgs, much less new physics that we don't fully understand. However, you know, if the coupling to the standard model sector is larger than the dark matter, this branching ratio could be very large. This might be something where you're producing a scalar, it's going into BB bar, and if we're not sensitive to that, you know, that's a little scary. If we can't find even a 100 GeV particle going to BB bar, you know, that's physics that we could be missing. I think there's some interesting links, possibly, to extended Higgs sectors. I think there's sort of well-motivated, really interesting work to be done. And we don't have a lot of time left before we start getting more data again. So we should make sure we have everything sort of arranged before that happens. So that's it.
More questions for Matt?
You had a plot showing the MET spectrum for, I think when you, for the two benchmark masses.
Yeah.
This was from a while ago, I guess. I was surprised to find that the shape between the two different benchmarks is the same. Like, I expect, so is this for the...
It's not actually the same. It's just, remember you're living way, way out on the tail of these MET distributions. If I had plotted the MET at lower values, there's a more noticeable difference. I realize that me saying that they're not exactly the same, it's very hard to see.
Yeah,
but we were a little surprised by that, but then when we looked at the full distribution, it was clear that we were, and the other thing to remember is that I have rescaled these so they're equal. I've rescaled the coupling so that you can actually see these on the same plot. Right. This is the model that you'd actually be able to constrain. So I had to scale the coupling up simply because the mass is higher. I think if I had gone up to like a much heavier mediator, you'd see a more noticeably different couple.
Whereas, as opposed to a heavy dynamic, it would be a very different.
No, I totally agree. It's just that this is not sort of heavy enough for this to be really noticeable in this plot.
Any other questions? Well, we sort of returned to you watching the talk, so let's thank you again.